Long before the O.J. case, before the Night Stalker, before the Manson murders, the Black Dahlia case grabbed the public's throat and never really let go. The 1947 murder of an attractive brunette named Elizabeth Short launched the largest manhunt and murder investigation in the history of the LAPD. It's still an open case. It has not been officially solved, or has it? The grisly and gruesome homicide has been made into books and movies and TV shows. It's inspired songs. It's created its own sort of mini industry of amateur detectives and true crime authors who all have their own theories about who the killer was. Well, Steve Hodell is not an amateur sleuth. He is a veteran police officer, a decorated homicide detective for the LAPD. He spent nearly 24 years with that agency, and like everyone else in Hollywood, he had at least a passing interest in that infamous murder. Later, though, after he retired, he uncovered information about his own father that led him down a rabbit hole and caused terrible anguish, but also led to what sounds like a very well-documented solution to this case. His book, Black Dahlia Avenger, a New York Times bestseller, and no wonder, it is meticulously investigated, highly detailed, absolutely mesmerizing. We're going to jump into the Black Dahlia case with Steve Hodell in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM. The book is called Black Dahlia Avenger, and we're joined now by Steve Hodell, the former LAPD detective who wrote it. Steve, welcome to the program for the first time.
Thanks, George. Good to be with you.
Man, I got to tell you, this is a heck of a piece of work by you. I mean, it is not a casual undertaking. 500 pages, dozens of witnesses, hundreds of leads and documents and evidence, and I'm guessing you're still working on it. You're still going to.
It's just been, you know, you mentioned a rabbit hole. It's really a black hole. Can't seem to get out of it. It's amazing how more and more information just keeps coming to me. Much of it from readers, I must say, assisting. It's been an amazing journey.
You know, I see at the end of this book, this edition, an updated edition, there's some pushback, as you might expect. Now this can't be right. But I'm thinking to myself, you know, for you, this would have been a lot easier to stop. I mean, and I think you even wrote in the book at one point, I almost wish I hadn't done this because it is extremely painful for you.
Yes, it really has been. I mean, it's really been an amazing journey. And now we're into, you know, it started in 99, so we're 20 years into it, and I'm still dealing with, I mean, we had some amazing new evidence, which we'll talk about later, that came out just last year, you know, huge, huge linkage to the crime. So it's I just can't get out of it.
Well, we're going to jump into the deep end of the pool here, but can you set the stage for us? Why this case? Why did it grab public attention and hold it for so long, all these years, decades?
Yeah, well, a bunch of things came together. So it's 1947 is when the crime occurred. And the timing of it was, you know, it was just before television caught on. So it was kind of the last big print story in 47. And then the victim's name, Black Dahlia, very mysterious, that caught on. And then the crime itself, which we'll get into, a young, beautiful woman coming to Hollywood, you know, in search of really, well, they say movies, but she wasn't. She was really in search of, it was wartime, just after the war, and she was in search of Lieutenant Wright, you know. So all of those things kind of came together, and then you had the six newspapers in Los Angeles, each vying for headlines, and it was literally above the fold headlines for 40 days.
You write in the book about how this is in the era before we learned a great deal about serial killers, like some of the examples I was mentioning, and it seems like they're fairly much more common now, but that these kinds of cases are solved literally the gumshoe approach of your shoe leather. You found a lot of stuff that just wasn't done, or if it was done, it was stuffed in a drawer somewhere that the public never saw.
Yeah, that's true. It's, of course, the term serial killer didn't even exist back then. That didn't surface until, I think, about the mid-80s when that term came up. Back then, in the old days, they called them chain killings. And you also got to understand the time and the place. L.A. back then was very corrupt. I mean, it was a real-life L.A. Confidential. and half the department was on the take. And of course, this was all news to me. My career was 24 years. I was on from 1963 to retired in 86, and I was part of that Chief Parker's new breed. And I assumed everybody, we were the good guys, and cops did it the right way. I was completely unaware of the history of LAPD and the corruption. So that was a real, as I got into this and got stuck into the weeds of it, it was really a shock to me to discover how corrupt LAPD was back then.
You're there for 24 years at LAPD. You start out as a regular patrol officer, police officer, rise to detective, and then to homicide detective. Did you ever, now looking back on it, you kind of wish you had gone back to the files and taken a look.
Yeah, well, they weren't open to, so my career was 6 years uniform patrol, and I worked four different divisions from 63 to 68. And then I took the exam and I passed and I got into Detective Bureau at Hollywood Homicide. And I worked all the tables, as a young rookie detective, you go around the different tables, robbery, auto theft, sex crimes. Eventually I worked my way after a few years to homicide, where I basically stayed for the next 17 years and had over 300 murder investigations I personally investigated. And retired in 86. And, LAPD, I was long retired before any of this came to me. I really didn't even know. I'd heard of the Black Dahlia, of course, as a famous unsolved. But I really didn't know any of the details. I didn't even know the victim's name. And then I'm 14 years into retirement and get that 2 a.m. call that starts this thing. And on this journey, and it's just an amazing trip ever since then.
Well, let's start there. The 2 a.m. call comes in. It's about the death of your father.
Okay, so I'm living in Bellingham, Washington, which is kind of like the last stop before Canada. And I had moved. My boys were like 5 and 7, and we had moved out of L.A. to get away. We were having a lot of gang activity back then in the mid-'80s. So I kind of wanted to get them out of the mean streets of L.A. and took them up, and we wound up relocating to Bellingham. And I became a PI up there, a licensed PI. I was licensed in California too, and I'm doing my PI work and stuff. And I get a phone call from my father's wife. He had relocated from Asia in 1990. He came back and settled in San Francisco in a high-rise 39th floor apartment condo in downtown San Francisco. And I, for that last decade, had become very close to my father, and I'd see him on a regular basis. He'd come up and visit me with his wife, June. Anyway, on May 16th, 1999, I get this 2 a.m. phone call. It's from June, his wife. He says, "Steve, your father's collapsed. The paramedics are here. They've just pronounced him dead. Come down." So I jump on a flight a few hours later, get down there, do all the things you have to do to take care of father's passing. And the next day or 2 days later, I'm there and sitting with June, and and she says, "Well, I think your father would want you to have this." She hands me this small album, like 3x5-inch photo album of his. Very old, and it's got pictures of my brothers and my mother and some pictures by Man Ray, who was a famous surrealist photographer. He was our family photographer. All kinds of interesting photos. And then there's this picture of a young 20-something dark-haired woman. And I turn to June and I say, "June, who is this?" And she's reclining and nude, obviously, from the waist up. And she says to me, "I don't know, somebody your father knew from a long time ago." And I look at the picture, and to this day, George, I don't know why, but Black Dahlia comes to mind. Now, I had no reason, I had known about the Black Dahlia murder from the Academy. you know, when you go through, they show us all the photos and it's a famous unsolved. But that was basically it. In 75, they did a TV movie with Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. and Lucy Arnaz playing Dahlia. And I saw that television movie in 75, but it may have been the source, but for whatever reason, Black Dahlia comes to mind, comes in and goes out of my mind. I don't think much of it. Fast forward to a couple of days later, and I had become very close with my father in that last decade. And I hope we have a chance to talk about his biographics, because you really have to understand the man to understand the crime. Anyway, I'm on the phone with my half-sister, Tamar. She's in Hawaii. And we're talking about the great man's passing and what a remarkable life he had, what an amazing human being he was. And she says to me out of nowhere, she says, well, you know, he was a suspect in the Black Dahlia murder. And I says, Tamar, what the hell are you talking about? Where is this coming from? She says, well, he didn't do it, but he was a suspect back then. I says, what are you saying? And she says, well, and of course, we'll talk about her. She was the victim of a trial incest with my father.
Oh, my God.
She says, but when I was taken, the police were taking me to, back and forth to the trial. They said that they thought he was a killer of the Black Dahlia. He was a suspect, but he didn't do it. But that's all she knew, was that the cops had told her that he was a suspect.
Well, let me set this up this way, is that, you know, you mentioned, you used the phrase, the great man. You know, that's you and your siblings had looked at this guy. But it was not just his greatness and his genius, because he was a brilliant guy in many ways, but there's a sense of fear, too. I mean, for a long time, you had no communication. He was gone.
Right.
Or at least you didn't see him. He left the country.
That's right.
For 40 years.
Yeah, well, he was in and out, but so basically what happened was, there was the incest. He was arrested for incest in 1949 with my half-sister, Tamar, the one I'm on the phone with. She was 14, and it was a big trial, and I don't know, maybe we should do, should we do his biographic?
Yeah, let's do the bio first, and then we'll lead up to that. So
okay.
He's a brilliant man as a musical prodigy as a youngster.
Exactly. So born in Los Angeles in 1907, downtown L.A., directly across the street from the Biltmore Hotel. And single child, his parents, Russian immigrants, they came through Paris to Ellis Island, came out to L.A. At the turn of the century. George is born in 07. By the age of 7 or 8, he's a musical prodigy, playing his own piano concerts at the Shrine Auditorium, highly gifted. His piano instructor, he's beating out all these adults for these contests, and his music teacher predicts he'll have a bright future as a pianist. Goes to my grandfather, his father builds a beautiful home in the South Pasadena area, and he's going to South Pasadena High. Not only is he a musical genius, but he's also highly intelligent, 186 IQ, one point above Einstein. Oh. That skips a generation, but my boys are in good shape. Both my boys are in good shape. So he's this, you know, highly gifted. He scores the highest public scores in school. He then transfers, he graduates at 14, goes to Caltech, enters Caltech at 14, or I guess he just turned 15, and he's going to Caltech. A year into his studies there, he has an affair with a professor's wife at 15. She gets pregnant, breaks up her marriage with her husband, and she goes back east and has the child, his child, a girl, which she aptly names Folly, and George follows her back. Now he's 15 or 16. He follows her back, says, I want to marry you. I want to be the you know, I want to raise the child. And the professor's wife laughs at him and says, George, you're a child yourself. Get out of my life. Go away. I never want to see you again. So he comes back to L.A. and starts, and there's so many ironies in this story. He starts driving a cab, a yellow cab, out of the Biltmore, with another young cab driver who's going to law school, and his name is William H. Parker, and he will eventually become chief of police, our greatest police chief on LAPD. Anyway, they're driving cabs together downtown. He then passes himself off as 21, gets a job with the LA Record, which is one of the large newspapers back then. And he's a crime reporter for the Record. And this is, of course, now we're into like 1925, 26. So it's Prohibition. He's riding around with the vice guys, kicking doors, and writing these tabloid stories about the professor's wife. I mean, the lawyer's wife having an affair and stuff. And then he graduates and he starts riding around with LAPD homicide and going to their crime scenes and writing the bloody ace of spades next to the body and stuff.
So he's drawn to that kind of stuff.
Say again?
He's drawn to that violent, grisly sort of element.
I mean, he's got, and you know, later on in the book and in the later books, I try and look at a bunch of the triggers that, you know, for his, you know, his problems and that may have set him off. But you're right. He was totally drawn and fascinated by all of this. I mean, it was, so then he decides to, so he starts double dating in the mid-20s, and he starts dating a woman by the name of Dorothy, and his best friend is John Huston, who will become the famous film director. But at that time, he was just basically the son of Walter Huston, who was a famous, his father was a very famous actor and successful actor, stage and screen. So John and their high school buddies, so John and George are double dating, and suddenly, and John is dating a woman by the name of Emilia. And after about a month or so, John falls in love with Dorothy, and they switch. And they run off. He falls in love with Dorothy, takes away from George. They run off to New York, and they get married. They're teenagers, 18, 19. And George looks at Emily and says, I guess it's you and me, babe. She gets pregnant. They both go north, and he decides to join. He's pre-med at Berkeley. He does that for 4 years, and across the bay to UCSF, San Francisco, gets his MD. And graduates in 1936. And jump in if you want. I know I'm doing a lot.
No, this
of
is great.
Narrating
it's great.
Here, but
it's awesome.
Okay, so he gets his MD. Also, not only is he musically gifted and intellectually gifted, he's also has an amazing eye-hand coordination, and he's super skilled at surgery. And all of his professors there at the medical school are vying for him to be their assistant because he's so naturally gifted. So, and he puts in, I got the transcripts, he did over 800 hours of surgery. He graduates, and at this time he also has affairs with different women up there.
I'll tell you what, hold on a second, Steve. We'll pick up the story on the other side here of the break. The Rolling Stones take us into the break. We're talking about the Black Dahlia case with Steve Hodell. We'll be right back. Talking about the Black Dahlia case, how did that nickname, where was that born, and why did it stick? We're talking with Steve Hodell about his book, Black Dahlia Avenger. He got a call in 1999, as we just learned, about the death of his father, and within a few days, he obtains a small photo album, and in it, he sees photos of what looked like the Black Dahlia herself, and he begins a journey of discovery that soon becomes very painful and is still underway as he peels back the layers, discovering things about his father that he never knew, including that this was a brilliant man who had several different careers crammed into his life, but he had a dark side, a very dark side, that spilled over into the rest of the family and well beyond that. We're going to get into more about what he learned about his father and what it's meant to his life as well, right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Steve Hodell, you're sharing with us all these details about your father's fascinating life. I mean, as a musical prodigy, as a youngster, and then he's driving a cab. He becomes a crime reporter. He goes to med school. He was at Caltech at a young age, impregnates this woman. Did you know all this stuff about your dad before?
No, I didn't, actually. He was a real man of mystery. I mean, I knew that he had gone to Caltech. I knew a few things, but no. Until I started this, you know, twofold path after his death is when I began to unfold and interviews with, you know, people and stuff. I eventually learned this, but most of it was total. I had no clue to any of this.
After you get the photo album from your stepmom, June, your antenna go up, but not only because of the recognizing that that might be the Black Dahlia, but because of how she is reacting to this and how secretive she is with you, right? You're a cop. You can smell this out.
Yeah, I just had a feeling, but to be truthful, it came and went, and I didn't think much of it. I thought, you know, and, you know, the truth is, well, we'll get into it later, but, you know, really, of course, it was the next day that when Tamar, my half-sister, says to me, you know, he was a... And to be clear, I had had maybe 20 minutes of conversations with my half-sister in 50 years. It wasn't like we were on the phone regularly, you know. She, after what happened to her, which we'll talk about a little bit later, she kind of spun out and got into sex, drugs, rock and roll. And so, you know, we just, our paths verged and we had no real communication, very rare communication.
The fact that your father had these surgical skills that you were just describing, that becomes pretty key later on.
It really does. And a couple of other things. So if we jump back to his biographics, so he's actually in 1928 with Emilia, he has a son born to him named Duncan, who's born in 28. Then he has an affair with another woman named Dorothy, not the earlier Dorothy that was with Houston, but a different Dorothy, and has a daughter named Tamar. So that's my half-sister and my half-brother. But Tamar is born in 35. So, and he graduates from medical school in 36. So the two little kids are there, and he decides he needs some space to get out of it. So he takes off on his own, and he takes a job as a surgeon in a CCC camp. FDR started the camps, and he became sole surgeon at a logging camp in Arizona. Becomes a district health officer for New Mexico and Arizona, and then he starts doctoring to the reservations, the Hopi and Navajo reservations, for a year or two. And then he comes back to Los Angeles, and he applies and gets a job with the LA County Health Department as a VD specialist, specializing in VD, venereal disease control. He quickly rises to the top in a few years and becomes the VD health officer for the entire county of Los Angeles.
Pretty influential spot in those days, because Hollywood excesses. It gives
very
you
much a... so. It was, yeah, he was, and he was the head of the head of it. And so he was, you know, he had all of this sensitive information. And at this point, Dorothy, the original Dorothy, has broken up after 7 years of marriage with John Houston. She comes back. She hooks back up with George, and they get married. And my older brother is born in 39. I come along in 41, and my younger brother, Kelvin, is born in 42. So Dad's now married to Dorothy Houston Hodell, and she has three boys, two brothers and I. And he decides that, befitting his position as head of LA County Health Department, he needs a really cool house. So he buys what many of your listeners may know of as the Soden House. It's a Mayan temple in the heart of Hollywood, and it was built by Lloyd Wright, son of Frank Lloyd Wright. And it was built in 26, and it literally is a Mayan temple right in the heart of it, right at Hollywood and Franklin. So we all move in there, the three, you know, and he's connected with the movie people and a lot of Hollywood celebrities, and he has this powerful position as head of LA County Health. A lot of parties, a lot of cocktail parties and stuff. And he buys the house in 45. So it's really very cool, and all of my memories of that time are just magical ones. I mean, we were living, you know, I've got this handsome, debonair father, a beautiful mother, and we're the three little princes running around in this gorgeous temple, you know, castle.
But you don't have a clue what's going on right around you.
I don't have a clue what's going around. All I know is it's really cool, and I love my father, and I love my mother, and I love all of these happy people. And everything's going great. And then in 1949, there's a knock at the door, and it's LAPD. And they say, Dr. Hodel? And he says, yes. And they said, you're under arrest for incest. So what had happened was Tamar is now 14. She came down for that summer of 49 to be with us. And dad had a sexual affair with her. And
well, not just him.
No, he had an affair with her, but it was like, he took her into his bedroom, and there were actually three other adults present, two women and another male by the name of Fred Sexton, who was a lifelong friend of his and actually becomes an accomplice in some of these in the story. But anyway, he's arrested by LAPD and booked, and Tamar had run away and after the sexual encounter, and she actually disclosed it to our mother, Dorothy, and Mom said, oh my God, your life's in danger, you've got to get out of here, you know. And so she runs away, and she's gone, like, hiding with her friends, her teenage friends, for 2 or 3 days. Cops find her, take her in, say, why did you run away? And she basically discloses it. She says, because my life is so crazy. They say, what do you mean? And then she discloses the sexual encounter with her father and the other adults.
And reveals that there are a lot of sex parties there that you're
yeah, well, she's...
Or that comes out eventually.
Yeah, it does. Actually, that's a little distorted. They weren't like open sex parties. They were more behind closed doors type things. And because I, you know, my brothers and I, we never saw any sex parties or anything like that. But it was more of a, actually, I think Tamar's interpretation was, she says he was always, there were women lined up at the door, at his bedroom. Actually, I think what it was he was treating them for the VD disease, you know. Women were being privately treated, probably prostitutes. You know, there was a whole Brenda Allen scandal back then, and I suspect it was a lot of prostitutes that he was treating on the QT, you know.
I kind of confuse this part, but did he impregnate your sister before the incident that she reported to the cops?
Yeah, she got pregnant and she had an abortion. She got pregnant. Now, she was probably sleeping with other men. So I'm not convinced that it was George that impregnated her, but whatever. She got pregnant, and she demanded that she had to have an abortion. So dad, you know, worked that out. He got a doctor in Beverly Hills to perform an abortion on her. And this all comes out in the trial. So he gets arrested, he bails out, he hires Jerry Geisler, who was like the Johnny Cochran of that day. He was actually the top criminal defense attorney in the whole nation. He never lost a case, and he handled primarily celebrity cases, actors, actresses, mostly sex crimes. And so there was a three-week trial in November, December of 49.
And it's hugely sensational and scandalous.
It is. Above the fold, headlines, you know, L.A. County health doctor arrested for child molestation, incest. And it was a slam dunk case because you got three adults present, you know, who have to testify, and who were interviewed by the police and admitted seeing it. So it's like, you know, this is a slam dunk case. And how many times do you have an incest where you have actual witnesses other than the, you know, the parent and the child? Anyway, 3-week trial, and the verdict, and the jury comes back with a verdict, and kind of an OJ 45-minute comes back with a not guilty. And basically what Geisler and his partner, Neeb, attorney, they painted Tamar with a pathological liar brush. You know, she's making this all up. And even though two of the witnesses testified, the third witness refused. So she was arrested for perjury because she had already told the police that she had witnessed it. So anyway, and then later we'll find out that apparently there was a payoff of 15 grand, which is a lot of money back then, to the DA's office. But anyway, he's acquitted. Next thing we know, he's gone. He leaves the country in early 1950. And we don't know anything of this. Now, as you know, we're little, I'm what, 8, 9 years old, and my brothers and I, and we don't know. We're put into military school and kept, you know, hit, you know, we have no idea what's going on. All we know is suddenly our life is turned upside down. Dad's gone, and mom gets us out fairly shortly after that, and we start what I talk about, the gypsy years, where we kind of relocate to Palm Springs and Bastion and kind of bounce all around. But anyway, Dad's gone, and we really don't know anything about anything until I'm a little older, when I'm a young teenager, mom, you know, the story comes out.
I want to back up to the second about your sister, Tamar. So she runs away from home, and the family has to reluctantly report it to the police. They track her down and find her, and she starts spilling all this stuff about sexual stuff at the house and the incest with the dad. And she also tells them something else about the Black Dahlia. But you don't find that out until years later.
No. She doesn't tell them about the Black Dahlia.
She tells you about it.
No. So the trial starts, and they're taking her to court. This is LAPD and the DA's detectives. She's detained in juvenile hall. Okay. And while she's in juvenile hall, she's being transported back and forth to testify in court. And they tell her, the detectives tell her, that they suspect George is the Black Dahlia suspect.
Oh, boy.
Follow me?
Yeah.
Okay. So, and that's all she knows. They just say that, you know, he's a suspect in the Black Dahlia murder, and that's all she knows. No details or anything. And that, of course, she never reveals that to me until this phone call, 40, 50 years later. Anyway, he's found not guilty, and he eventually, in about April, May of 50, he is gone. He's left the country. So he goes on to Hawaii, which was a territory at the time, and becomes a psychiatrist, counsels to the criminally insane at the hospital there for a while, and then marries a rich Filipino woman, goes on to Manila, has 4 more children, is married to her for like 3 or 4 years. They divorce. He then gets into market research, becomes the leading expert in all of Asia in market research, which was, of course, brand new right then in the 50s, and has companies in 20 different, has offices in 20 different countries, hooks up with June in about 69, and they get married, and he, you know, in the market research, he's coming in and out of the U.S. on occasion, but it's like very secretive. I'll get a phone call on occasion. It'll be Dad, and he'll say, round up the boys and meet me at the Century City Hotel for, you know, dinner or something. I'm here for 2 days.
And so in retrospect, it looks like he's zipping in and out. Maybe it's not just because it's business, but because he doesn't want to get caught.
Occurred to me. It was just like, this is the, you know, Dad is a, you know, high-powered mover and shaker, and he just, you know, that's just the way he is. He was always very mysterious, you know, so, and played it very close to the vest. So I didn't think much of it. And then eventually, of course, in 1990, he relocates back with June to San Francisco, and I start seeing him on a regular basis, and I have a close, for whatever, so he now has 11 children by five different women, okay? And for whatever reasons, I was his favorite, go figure. But anyway, he'd come up and visit me, I'd go down and visit him on a regular basis. We became, you know, he was never a warm, fuzzy kind of dad, but he was, you know, gentler, softer, and so I felt good, you know, I mean, it was a good, I was glad that I was able to, you know, get some, you know, even though it wasn't any hard information, at least I felt, you know, a closeness from the estrangement. And then he dies, and I get the phone call, and so that's kind of basically, that starts me on the, on this investigative path. Tamar says he was a suspect in the detectives told her he was a suspect in the Dahlia case. Well, so I start out and I say, there's no way. Absolutely not. Yeah, I believe the, I believe you were a victim of incest. I know Dad was obsessed sexually. That was a problem with him. But there's no way this, you know, that he could have been a killer. So I start looking into the Dahlia murder itself. Like I say, I didn't even know her name. And I discover, the first thing I discover, of course, is that they suspect that first I find out her name is Elizabeth Short, and she was 22, and they believe that she was, you know, surgically bisected. Well, yeah, Dad was a surgeon, but still, you know, that there's no way he could do it. And then the next thing that comes in, I start getting into it, I'm sure I'll be able to exonerate him.
I'll tell you what. Hold on a second. We'll take a break, and when we come back, I want you to sort of talk about the crime and the scene, and sort of set the stage there, who she was, and what you've learned about her, and then we'll get into where she crossed paths, possibly with your father. We're talking with Steve Hodell about the Black Dahlia case and what he's learned about not only the case and the victim, but his own father and what might be his role in it. We'll be right back with more Coast to Coast AM right after this.